Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up in the next half hour, new information on the opioid epidemic, a report on the overabundance of painkillers on the market and in the pipeline. Also, part two in our Just Ask series, which looks at Ohioans living with disabilities. Up first, this week, the Justice Department announced it's ending an investigation into the fatal shooting of John Crawford III, a black man who was killed by a white police officer inside a Beaver Creek Walmart in 2014. As WISO's April Leslie reports, a Crawford family attorney says the news comes as a major disappointment.
Federal authorities announced they would not pursue civil rights charges in the case, citing insufficient evidence. They said investigators analyzed store surveillance video, interviewed witnesses, and used an independent crime scene reconstruction expert in their review. Crawford family attorney Michael Wright says he's puzzled by the Justice Department's decision.
It's just somewhat hard to understand with the evidence that we have that they do not believe, or they took the position that the evidence is insufficient for them to prosecute these officers.
Nearly 3 years ago, Beaver Creek police officer Sean Williams shot 22-year-old John Crawford III after a 911 caller reported a man waving a rifle inside the store. Police say Crawford didn't obey commands to drop what they later learned was an air rifle he had picked up from the store shelf. Crawford's relatives have said Crawford was given less than a second to respond to commands from police. The shooting sparked protests nationwide. Wright says he believes the case was clear-cut.
Clearly, Mr. Crawford was doing nothing wrong. Clearly, the officers did not assess the situation. Clearly, based on the officer's statements, they lied regarding the facts and circumstances leading to Mr. Crawford's death. So based on the totality of that, I believe that they should have, in fact, moved forward with prosecuting the officers.
The Beaver Creek Police Department has maintained the officers committed no criminal violations and followed accepted law enforcement protocol. A federal investigation into the case was launched after a Greene County grand jury declined to indict anyone involved in the case. In a statement Tuesday, U.S. Attorney Benjamin Glassman said prosecutors would have to show, beyond a reasonable doubt, that officers willfully violated Crawford's civil rights. Glassman said the evidence, quote, simply could not satisfy those burdens. The Crawford family has filed a civil lawsuit against Beaver Creek Police and Walmart stores alleging negligence and civil rights violations. Wright says the case will go to trial in February of next year. The city and Walmart have both denied the allegations in the suit. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
Following the announcement from the DOJ Wednesday, community members rallied in Dayton. Bishop Richard Cox from the group Justice for Racial Equality and Brotherhood says Crawford's case was mishandled.
We are here because we are dissatisfied with the Justice Department who decided to close this case. We will be organizing this community and ask them to come out and support this family. We're calling on every citizen in Dayton, Ohio to join us here. And we're going to protest loud and clear.
And you can find out more on the Crawford case on our website at WYSO.org. A new report on the opioid epidemic that has swept through Ohio and the nation recommends more training and treatment, and a different kind of review by the FDA of painkillers that are already on the market and new ones as they're being developed. For Ohio Public Radio, WKSU's ML Schulze spoke with the Ohio researcher who was on the team that prepared the report for the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine.
Lee Hoffer is a medical anthropologist at Case Western Reserve University and one of the team that spent more than a year researching and compiling the report. He's been studying the impact of drugs since the mid-90s, but says he's seen nothing of this magnitude.
The scope of the interventions that are needed to reverse this trend or even plateau it are monumentally large. You have doctors, you have medical professionals, you have drug treatment, you have harm reduction, you have research, a lot more research, both laboratory and social science research is needed. This report doesn't even talk about law enforcement or incarceration issues.
One of the things that kind of surprised me in reading this report, when it comes to looking at how opioids were prescribed for chronic pain, and I don't want to simplify it too much, but it seems to almost say a really good dose of aspirin may always have been the better choice. Am I misreading?
No, I don't think really you are. In fact, based on all the clinicians, their recommendations and all of the data that we looked at, these drugs are really powerful, and they should be really used as almost a last resort and for acute pain primarily. There's not a lot of evidence that long-term these medications are good for anybody.
As I understand, one of the core recommendations of this group when we're looking at the FDA is to take a different approach than what it usually does when it approves a drug. Can you explain the nuance of that difference?
Essentially, the big difference really in this report is that we were looking at opioids and making recommendations to the FDA by taking really a public health perspective where it's not just one drug, right? It's the combination of these drugs and the fact that there's a big market for them and that there are already a lot of consequences associated with their use. So, you know, we wanted to bring a sort of a broader picture to the question of how these drugs are approved and how the FDA should look at them.
So it's not just a matter of take a look at the efficacy for an individual patient, but at what it does to, by extension, the family and the community and the our whole culture as a result. And then there's also a lot of talk about education for the healthcare providers and for the public.
Oftentimes, medical professionals and doctors in particular don't get a lot of training on actually the management of pain, but also the use of opiates to manage pain. We wanted to try to maintain a balance of being able to say that, well, you know, in certain circumstances, these are very important medications and they can be used to help people. And we don't want to deny people the ability to, you know, alleviate their pain. At the same time, we need to be careful. There needs to be an understanding that these drugs are dangerous.
Somebody I was talking to a couple of weeks ago said, how can anybody not be aware in this day and age of what the problem can be? And it was actually part of a three-person discussion. The other one said, hey, when your doctor tells you this is a good idea, suddenly those broad messages don't register. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I mean, doctors have a lot of sort of power in patient decision making. And this isn't to say that doctors are being irresponsible, but I think patients also bear some responsibility here in maybe asking the doctor questions about the medication. Do they really need the medication? Are there some other lower or non-opioid medications or some other therapy that might be useful here that they might try first? And it's tricky with doctors because they're under such time pressures, right, with their patients. And patients want results quickly and these kinds of things.
Treatment was the other aspect of the report. Can you sum up what the recommendations are there?
Much more of it is needed. I mean, this was the big recommendation of the report. It's not really all that earth-shattering, of course. And the medicated assisted treatment, MAT, is really the recommendation that's been known to be sort of the most effective. Now, that's not to say that other sort of therapies, you know, might be incorporated in that as well.
That's Lee Hoffer of Case Western Reserve University, one of the researchers who compiled the report on pain management and the opioid crisis. The report also recommends expanding the availability of Narcan and other interventions. Hoffer says they're often the best hope to eventually open someone up to treatment. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm ML Schulze.
We've got more stories to follow on the opioid epidemic on our website at WYSO.org. July marks nearly three decades since the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. All this month, WYSO is bringing you stories of Ohioans living with disabilities. It's a series we're calling Just Ask, talking about disability. Thousands of people with disabilities rely on public transit in the Miami Valley. And today we take you to a workshop designed to give Greater Dayton RTA bus drivers personal insight into what many passengers with disabilities experience every day. Five newly hired Greater Dayton RTA drivers gather in a large fluorescent-lit room with volunteers from the Access Center for Independent Living in Dayton. Tables have been set up, each one manned by a volunteer who hands each driver a different piece of equipment designed to simulate a vision, hearing, or dexterity impairment, including masks, dark goggles, and noise-canceling headphones.
What I really want you to think about is your day-to-day activities, from the time you get up to the time you go to bed.
Access Center Assistant Director Greg Kramer tells the drivers the exercises they'll go through today will give them important insight into what it's like to live with a disability.
I want you to think about what you experience at each table and how that disability would impact your life.
We just sign the back of here?
Yeah, just sign our check and get it in the envelope.
Yeah, I fold it.
Volunteer Vicky Logue instructs two drivers who have had their hands bound in gauze. Their task, to sign a check as if they're paying a bill, put that check into an envelope, then seal it, stamp it, and send it.
Okay, once you've signed your check and folded it into the envelope.
Without the use of hands, this everyday task becomes a monumental challenge. The drivers awkwardly use their elbows to work the pens, paper, and stamps. It takes them almost 10 minutes to complete the task. And on the other side of the room, volunteer Wanda Sloan presents two more drivers with another challenge. Sloan is visually impaired, and although she herself is able to see differences in light and shadow, she plunges the drivers into total darkness, putting each of them in a mask that blocks their sight completely. Sloan leads them out into the halls of the building. The drivers are completely out of their element as they try to navigate the hallway.
Sidewalks are scrape, scrape, scrape. This is a floor. This is a wall. See the difference in the sound?
Okay. Floor and the wall.
Yeah, there's a difference in the sound, so it lets you know where you're at.
So you learn all the differences.
Oh, sure. Floor. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But what if, like, you touch a person like that? You don't hear anything.
I'm just playing with you.
How'd
you like that?
That was scary.
Yeah, a little bit.
Uncomfortable.
Yes.
About 30,000 people use RTA buses in Dayton every day. Officials say 21% of those riders have a disability. In an effort to better serve this population, the RTA requires new drivers to complete this disabilities training. Access Center employee Richard Ball says the training is urgently needed to help drivers become more aware of what riders with disabilities go through.
Most of the time you're in a wheelchair, you're down too low because and nobody really sees you. But when they see you, they're looking at you like there's something wrong with you. It makes them scared in a way to be out into the public.
And that fear of being out in public, how people with disabilities are seen by others, is at the heart of the next exercise the drivers will have to go through. Volunteers give each driver a manual wheelchair. As first-time users, they're unsteady as they roll down the hallway.
Ready?
Outside, it's raining, adding to the challenge. A van pulls up to the Access Center to take them to downtown Dayton. They line up their wheelchairs and wait to be loaded into the van. It's a service they themselves will have to provide passengers once they're assigned routes. The van arrives at the RTA hub between Main and Jefferson Streets in downtown Dayton. Once they're unloaded, the drivers make their way into a nearby food court plaza. But first, they have to negotiate their way around sidewalk construction scaffolding and through a narrow passageway. Finally, the drivers enter the plaza and steer their wheelchairs through the busy midday crowd. The group draws stares from many of the plaza's visitors. Driver James Thompson says the day's training helps him relate to passengers with disabilities.
It's a very humbling experience of what I'm going through right now to see what people that are handicapped go through every day on a day-to-day basis.
Back at the Access Center, Greg Kramer, the volunteers and drivers share what they've learned during the training.
I think we really open up their eyes. We get them to understand what it's like to have different types of disabilities, and we hope that they take that with them, and then they can also become advocates.
And Kramer says he hopes the drivers walk away with a better understanding of the passengers they serve. Jerry Kenney, WYSO. Jerry Kenney, thanks for joining us. At least three big school districts are pleading with state education officials to take a closer look at what they think is a major discrepancy. This has to do with the test given to see if a third grader can advance to the next level in reading. State House correspondent Andy Chow filed this report.
For each of the last 3 years, around 130,000 third graders across the state take a reading test to track their proficiency. They have several chances to take that test throughout the school year and summer break to reach the score that's needed in order to advance to fourth grade. But district officials in Akron, Canton, and Columbus fear that many of their students won't hit that mark because of a problem with the tests. Columbus City Schools spokesperson Scott Varner says they're looking to state education leaders for help.
This isn't necessarily about a dumbing down of standards, but instead an inequity in how the state uses alternative assessments to measure the skills that, and proficiency that students have.
Here's the problem, according to Varner and the other districts. There are five tests that students can take, the official state test, or four alternative tests. The Ohio Department of Education sets the bar for the score a student needs to get on that state test in order to move out of third grade reading. Some call it a promotional score, others a cut score. ODE then takes that state score, works with the alternative test vendors, and determines what the promotional score would be for those tests as well. But Varner says data officials in Columbus have determined the promotional score on their alternative tests, the NWEA MAP test, is not equivalent to the state test. In other words, the students have to perform better on the alternative test compared to the state test. Varner argues that these alternative assessments are for students who might perform better with a test that approaches the subject in a different way,
which creates an unfair roadblock to those students who, simply because they test differently, now must reach a higher score than others.
Stephanie Dodd, a state school board member, says they need to start looking into more data about this problem immediately.
I would say it certainly looks as if something is not correct, and it's something that I feel we need to, as the department and the districts and the vendors need to look into to dig a little deeper to find out what's going on.
For Dodd, she believes if an inaccuracy is discovered and the promotional scores do not align, then it's possible to adjust those scores and apply the new ones retroactively.
If they do say the score should be lower, then we do need to look at then saying, well, then certainly these students maybe did meet the promotion score and should move on.
The education department did not have anyone available to comment, but did send out a lengthy written statement. In it, ODE defends the third grade reading guarantee and the important role it can play in a student's future learning. The department added that they're seeing a 10% increase of students reaching the promotional score compared to this time last year. However, they are also dedicated to researching this issue more as additional data comes in. The summer gives students one last shot at taking the tests, something Varner says has helped in the past.
But this year, that hurdle is so much higher because so many more students were facing the possibility of being held back because of these changed and inequitable scores.
Districts, including Columbus, tend to administer the test along with an alternative test to see which one a student does better on. Dodd believes further investigation into the possible problem will happen quickly and hopes to have a resolution before the beginning of the new school year. Andy Chow at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
And this week, Dayton Youth Radio comes to a close for the summer. Today's story is about a teenager's relocation to a different part of the country. Here's project coordinator Basim Blunt.
Dayton Youth Radio gives teenagers a chance to tell their own stories in their own words. And we hear them, trying to figure out what the world is all about. Maybe you're listening to this story with your teenager. We hope it creates open and honest dialogue with the young people in your life. This story is by Ben Roth, who talks about his experience being exposed to what we call hate speech. It's called Red State, Blue State.
My name is Ben Roth. I'm 16 years old and a sophomore at the Miami Valley School. I was born in Dayton, and I play soccer and basketball. In 2009, my family went on vacation to Atlanta because my mom went there one time and liked it. At least, that's what I thought at the time. But we were really going to visit because my parents were going to tell me and my younger sister that we were moving there. My dad worked at NCR, and the company had announced they were moving their headquarters from Dayton to Atlanta around that time. To keep his job, my dad had to move us all to Atlanta. I was devastated at first. I remember my sister and I both crying when our parents told us. I didn't want to leave all the opportunities I had at home in Dayton and my friends and family, but my parents had given us a lot of time to adjust to the move, and it's not like there was anything I could do about it. My first year in Georgia, I went to the local public school in fourth grade. I had never experienced so much misbehavior amongst students and strict behavior amongst teachers. We couldn't talk during lunch, and the teachers were very strict about it. I had always gone to a school where there was no misbehavior and misconduct. So seeing kids get sent to the office, constantly talking and not listening to the teachers, was a new experience. The next year in Georgia, I changed schools to a private school where there wasn't as much misconduct, but there was something else new I had never experienced. My classmates, for the most part, were Southern Baptist Christians and had many conservative political views. Of course, like what many Americans stereotype the Southern United States about, the kids grew up in consistently conservative and right-wing families. One example was when Barack Obama won the 2012 presidential election, and my classmates were furious. I heard my classmates saying Barack Obama needed to be killed and the term "no-bama." Another story was when I played tag with my friends and the person that was it was called the queer. That made me really mad inside, but I still played otherwise. Some of my classmates were very homophobic. A kid at my school was bullied and had very few friends because his parents were gay. One time, one of his dads was a chaperone for a trip we went on, and he was my chaperone. But the other kids complained to each other about the fact that their chaperone was a homosexual. We also did prayers at our assemblies, even though they considered it a non-denominational school. When I told my classmates I had never really gone to church much, they were shocked, and they acted like I had killed someone. I was still friends with most of the general kids in my class, and they were very nice to me. I didn't hate the kids at my school. I played sports with many of them, but I never really talked to them about many political topics, as I was worried they wouldn't want to be my friend if they knew I didn't agree with them. The experience of living in the South gave me a better sense of political diversity. During the recent election, I noticed that Donald Trump tried to appeal to the majority of conservative Southern voters by having similar political views and using tactics and slogans that would bring in those voters. Many of my classmates and family members here were shocked by how someone could vote for such a person and how he could actually win the election. But to many Southerners, he's perfect for a president in the majority of categories. And this experience in Georgia gave me a better understanding of the political diversity in the United States. I moved back to Ohio because my dad was able to keep his job and remains working there today. Over the 4 years I spent in Atlanta, I learned that the two states are very different, particularly with their demographics and political background. This diversity is what makes it difficult to work towards unity in our country. For Dayton Youth Radio at Miami Valley School, this is Ben.
That was a story entitled Red State, Blue State, written and produced by Ben Roth from the Miami Valley School. Special thanks to Ben's teacher, Lindsay Cummings. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basine Blunt.
To hear more Dayton Youth Radio stories, visit our website, wiso.org, or subscribe on Apple Podcast or Stitcher. Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of middle summer, the transition week to the Blackberry Moon, the week that the Sun enters Leo. July 19th is the 200th day of the year, and now the tide of summer reaches as far north as it can go and then starts to fall back towards the Gulf of Mexico. The rate of the retreat varies with each year, but the balance always shifts during the seventh month. The day's length becomes 1 to 2 minutes shorter every 24 hours, and the countryside responds with changing color and sound. At the start of the year's ebb tide, the land is in the middle of bee balm and coneflower bloom. Fireflies mate in the humid nights, and the first katydids and crickets chant after dark. Woolly bear caterpillars, chiggers, ticks, and Japanese beetles become more common. Thistledown unravels in the sun and collapses in the rain. Seed pods form on trumpet creepers. Milkweed pods emerge, and milkweed beetles still mate in the remaining blossoms. The first peaches and summer apples come in, and July's wild cherries ripen and elderberries set fruit. Blueberries are blue. Late summer's white snake root, cup plant, ironweed, boneset, wingstem, and tall coneflowers are budding. This year's ducklings and goslings are full grown by the 200th day of the year. Cicada calls balance the diminished cardinal song and robin song. Ruffed-winged swallows have started to move south, leading the migrations. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fifth week of middle summer. In the meantime, under the new blackberry moon, scout the fields and walkways for blackberries warmed by the sun in Leo.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.